Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, a radio show where we discuss something that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from WETS-FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. Our focus today is on one of those perennially controversial issues. You probably have strong feelings about it one way or the other. I'm speaking, of course, of school prayer. School prayer. Can a public school teacher or a public school principal lead public school children in prayer or not? To help me answer that question, I've got people on both sides of the issue. I have Annie Laurie Gaylor from the Freedom From Religion Foundation, who opposes school prayer, and I have former Congressman William E. Dannemeyer, who is very much in favor of school prayer and has, in fact, during his career, lobbied for the reinstitution of it time and time again. But before I get to those interviews, I have with me another expert, my student, Amber Howe of the Appalachian School of Law. Hello, Amber.
Hello.
And Amber is going to give us the lay of the land. She's going to talk to us about what the Supreme Court has said about school prayer. Now, the starting point in all of this, of course, is what?
The Establishment Clause.
The Establishment Clause. What is the so-called Establishment Clause?
Well, it's 10 words, part of the First Amendment, that says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. What does that have to do with school prayer?
Well, it all started in the 40s when the First Amendment and the Establishment Clause was incorporated to the states.
Right. So starting in the early 20th century, the Supreme Court, after a long lull, finally gets around to saying, you know, that First Amendment thing, that applies to state governments as well as to the federal government. And guess what? Public schools are part of the state government, right?
Yes, they are. Through their funding and through the idea that the state runs them, the state controls everything about them.
Right.
So
when a public school teacher or a public school principal does something, he or she is acting on behalf of the state.
Yes, that's how the court sees it.
Okay. Well, I guess that's kind of how it is, isn't it then? Okay, then is it constitutional for such a state actor, as we like to call them, a state official like a school principal or a teacher? Is it constitutional for one of them to lead the little kiddies in the public schools in prayer?
No, it's not.
No, it's not. Okay. Well, how did that come about? You said it was in the 1940s?
The 1947 case of Everson versus the Board of Education was the first time that they addressed anything that had to do with religion in the school, and it had to do with funding.
Funding schools, okay. So what did the court decide in that case?
In that case, the court found that it was constitutional because they were not only because it had to do with reimbursement of
what were the schools doing in that case?
They were reimbursing parents for their children using public transportation to get to school.
To private schools?
Private and public schools.
Oh, okay.
And so since it had nothing to do with religion per se, rather than the state making sure that these children were able to get to school, the court said that that was okay.
Okay, even though some of the kids in the Everson case were being transported to and from religious schools.
Yes.
Okay, so the court looked at religion for the first time in that case, and in that case said what was happening was okay.
Yes.
All right, what happened next?
Well, the next case happened in 1948, and that's the McCollum versus the Board of Education. And that's the case where the court says that you can't have, like, religious classes, Bible reading, that sort of thing happening in the classroom.
Yeah, in fact, in that case, wasn't that where they had two different courses? You could go to classroom A if you were Protestant and classroom B if you were a Catholic?
Yes. And then, if you were neither, then you were taken to another room and given additional homework.
So the penalty for not being either a Protestant or a Catholic is going sitting in a room and doing more homework.
Yes.
Was that constitutional?
No.
No, it was not. Okay. So, and that was on the basis of the Establishment Clause, right?
Yes.
Okay. Very interesting. What happened next? What's the next big case in this area?
Well, the next big case would have been Engel versus Vitale.
Oh, that rings a bell.
In 1962. Mm-hmm. In this case, the state of New York actually created its own prayer to be said every morning by the students. Now, the students could object and not participate, and their parents could stop them from participating. But it still had to be said every morning before class could begin.
Wait a minute. So the school, the official of the state, has an official state prayer that is recited in class at the beginning, and little Timmy or little Tina doesn't have to participate, but what, just sits there silently while everybody else says it?
Correct.
And, of course, they feel perfectly good about this.
Right. So
I see. Okay. And what did the Supreme Court say about this official state prayer of the state of New York?
The court found that an invocation of a prayer is a religious activity and that it had no basis in teaching. And that since it didn't have any basis in teaching, that it was inappropriate for it to be done in school.
I see. And that was the big one. That's the one you always hear about where people say the Supreme Court has banned school prayer. That's the one, the decision you're typically talking about.
Right. But the court is not saying that prayer can't happen, period. It's just saying that it can't have the illusion or the idea that someone looking at it from the outside wouldn't know that the state or the school is endorsing one over the other.
Yeah, I think it's very important to say right at this point when we talk about Engel that there's an old saying that anybody who thinks that there's no such thing as school prayer has forgotten about math tests. Of course there are prayers in school. They
right.
happen every day. Children pray to themselves, or they pray during recess, or they pray during the lunch hour, or they pray with each other around the flagpole before or after school. The key here was that the school officials could not sanction a particular prayer, could not lead the children or endorse a particular prayer.
That's correct. And also in the Engel, the court stresses that part of the reason why there is a separation of the church and the state, especially when it involves school children, is that religion is too sacred, too holy, too personal for the government to be involved in it. Because when the government becomes involved, you have other people who become isolated and feel that they don't have a voice.
Mm-hmm.
And so this keeps the government neutral so that people can believe what they want to believe without being isolated.
So it's not an anti-religion decision. It's actually, and as you describe it, a very pro-religion decision.
That's how a lot of the justices, when they write their opinions, they stress how they're not saying no to religion. They're saying no to the government being involved in the religion.
So that settled it then, right? So there's been no controversy since 1962 about school prayer?
No. In 1963, Abington Township, a case mm-hmm. in Pennsylvania,
right.
they were required to read 10 Bible verses a morning from the King James Version of the Bible.
Oh.
Well, it wasn't necessarily King James was required, but that was the Bible that was provided.
Mm-hmm.
If another student brought a Bible, they could use that, but King James was a version that was provided by the school. And again, the court said this has no place in teaching. It had no other purpose other than to further someone else's religion.
I see.
And so it didn't have a place. But the court said if they would talk about religion in the context of the history of society or how it's the role it's played in history, or that they're talking about comparative religions, the
right.
court said there's nothing wrong with that. But when you're teaching religion for the sole purpose of teaching religion and spreading the faith.
That's right. So you can teach about religion. You can teach about the Bible. Extremely important book, even if you're not a believer. It's a very, very important book.
It's kind of hard to talk about, like, the Crusades without talking about religion. Or
yeah.
talking about why the pilgrims came across to the New World without talking in some way about religion. And the court's saying that's fine because it has another purpose other than just for the purpose of talking about religion.
Right. So you can talk about the Bible in school, but you can't have church in school.
Correct.
Okay. So that settled it all, right? That was the end of it.
No, there's been a few more where the issue has come up about funding for the schools and also the use of an actual school building for religious groups.
For religious groups? And what has the court said about that?
The court says if you're going to allow other organizations to use the gym auditorium, and that's okay, then it's okay for a religious group to use the same gym auditorium.
Oh, that was the Lamb's Chapel case, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and that's important because I think a school district there got a little overzealous in trying to make sure it wasn't proselytizing, it wasn't indoctrinating children in religion, and it actually denied permission to a private Bible study group to use school facilities on an equal footing with non-religious groups. And the court said, nah, you don't have to go that far. In fact, you shouldn't go that far.
Right, because then it becomes another First Amendment issue, which is the freedom of speech.
And free exercise, I imagine.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, very good. So you don't have to completely eliminate any sort of religious discussion in school. You just have to make sure the state's not sponsoring it. Okay?
Then, of course, there's always the issue with Ten Commandments.
Right.
Which is a little bit beyond our scope. But then there's also an issue of student organizations.
Mm-hmm.
If the organization is created by students and it doesn't have anything to do with curriculum-based, mm-hmm. and the school has other non-curriculum-based organizations, then there can be a student-led religious organizations in schools. And then the next major issue that came up, there's two more, which would have
right.
been the... saying invocations and benedictions as prayers in graduations.
Like graduations, yeah, or high school football games, right.
Right, and that's the other case was prayer before football games.
Right, and generally speaking, those are not allowed either, are they?
No, they're not, because again, it gives the idea that the state is endorsing one over the other, and these are seen as things that in some way are part of the school experience.
Yeah, even though you're not required to go to a football game or even a graduation ceremony in most cases, so you're not a captive audience as you are in a classroom, the court's not been very friendly toward attempts to, again, have a particular prayer recited or a particular benediction or invocation at those things. Very interesting subject, and thank you very much for giving us the lay of the land. Well, Amber Howe has done a wonderful job of telling us what the court has said about school prayer. But as you might have guessed, not everybody agrees with those decisions. And here to speak to us next is a former congressman by the name of Bill Dannemeyer. And I think it's safe to say that Bill doesn't think much about these Supreme Court decisions and has some very strong opinions on the other side of the issue.
You know, I was a member of Congress from 1979 to 92, 14 years.
Right.
And I'm almost certain that each year I introduced legislation that would reinstate voluntary school prayer in America on the conviction that one of the most important things that any member of Congress could do was to affirm the existence of God as we teach the next generation. And so that's what prompted me to introduce this legislation. And after I left Congress in 1992, I continued in the work that I've described. I was a volunteer, man. I went to Washington for a number of years working with different members. And we actually brought this issue to a vote in 1998 in the House of Representatives. Congressman Istook of Oklahoma was the principal sponsor. And we won a constitutional amendment to reinstate voluntary prayer in public school. I think the vote was something like 225 to 204. That's not two-thirds.
Right, yeah. You needed the supermajority to do it, but you actually
right.
did get a majority of the
oh,
House
yeah. Yeah,
to,
right.
to
the,
vote.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And I'm sad to say that in that year, we couldn't get a vote in the U.S. Senate on the issue, and I'm deeply disappointed that we never could. But I continued my work as a volunteer, and I worked on this issue almost every year, spending my own money, by the way. And I last was in Washington on this issue in 2006 when I spoke to a religious group out in West Virginia on the issue. And I haven't been back to Washington on this issue since then. I have a number of grandchildren. I have nine granddaughters, one grandson. They're all in Lutheran parochial schools. And one of them will be visiting Washington in a month or so, and I plan to go back there and greet them a little bit. But that's my background and my conviction on the issue. I'm a Christian. I was raised in a Lutheran, in a Christian home by my mother. And so I have convictions. And I'm a graduate of Valparaiso University Christian School in Northwestern Indiana. And majored in political science. And if anything, my faith has, you know, been largely strengthened as a result of experiences I've gleaned in public life.
All right. Now, let's get a bit more explicit then. Now, you actually were trying to amend the Constitution for voluntary school prayer. So if it had been adopted, what would your amendment have done to the Constitution? What would it have
allowed? Well, it had the effect of overruling a decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in 1962, which erroneously interpreted the First Amendment, that decision, Engle versus Vitale, took away, you know, the right of... Actually, it was a decision, you know, that was, I think, crossed the line in terms of propriety, but U.S. Supreme Court, I think, made an erroneous decision saying we could no longer have voluntary prayer. We could no longer have that type of prayer in public school. And what I sponsored in the Constitutional Amendment was to make it voluntary, to make sure that we didn't get the state involved in dictating the content of the prayer or the having it said.
Okay, when you say voluntary prayer, now what exactly do you mean? You mean
students in a public school decide they want to, you know, have a prayer in, you know, the beginning of a school day, they can do it. It should not be directed by the teacher. It should be directed if the students want to have it. And I think that the voluntary is the way it makes it. That's the way it should be. Because there are students in that classroom that may not believe, you know, that God exists or that we should pray about anything. Except for recess.
Well, forgive me for asking, though, but isn't that sort of prayer allowed under current Supreme
Court
precedents?
Oh, no.
You mean students can't get together? I mean, I hear about these meet me at the flagpole type celebrations where students get together.
Well, you could do that. You could do that, I guess, but you cannot hold voluntary prayer in public schools today. It's just the way it is. And they... let me tell you, just, I'll read down the decisions that Engle versus Vitale in 1962 banned non-denominational prayer from public schools. They really, the beginning of this theft of our Christian heritage was Everson versus the Board of Education in 1947. It enacted a wall of separation between church and state. And then in 1980, Stone versus Graham removed the Ten Commandments in public school walls and struck down a period of silence not to exceed 1 minute for mediation or voluntary prayer. And then in 1985, Wallace versus Jaffrey, it censored creationist viewpoints when evolution viewpoints are taught. Now, think that over for a minute. But anyway, and then two more I'll mention. One more, I guess. 1992, Lee versus Wiseman. It barred prayers at public school graduation. So that's where we are.
Yeah, no, but all those decisions share the common denominator, if I'm not mistaken, that essentially what they're trying to do is get the school administration or school teachers out of leading or approving or forcing, in some cases, school prayer on the students. But don't they all still leave open the idea that certainly individual students can pray, certainly they can do it silently?
That
voluntarily students themselves could get together and have a prayer meeting as long as it wasn't interfering with class.
Yeah, but I tell you, the importance, I think, when Engle versus Vitale was decided in 1962, there was one of the justices who dissented from the decision. And his point was that when we mandate that you must attend a public school to get an education, and we direct by a wrongful interpretation of the First Amendment by the U.S. Supreme Court that you cannot mention God, you are putting to a serious disadvantage anybody who wants to affirm the existence of God as part of the educational process. And that's the reason that motivates me, is that there are twin goals in any educational process. One is that you teach competence or content, and the other is that you teach how we all got here. And I believe that, you know, God created this world and everything in it. And one of the ironies of this whole issue, I can tell you, Stuart, is that the American public are behind what I'm seeking to get done by big majorities. In 1985, 69% of Americans supported the school prayer. By 1991, that number had increased to 78. Similarly, in 1988, 68% of Americans supported a constitutional amendment to reinstate school prayer. By 1994, that number had risen to 73. So huge majorities are supporting what I'm talking about to get done.
Well, that's interesting, and if that's the case, then I wonder why you have such difficulty getting a constitutional amendment enacted.
I'm laughing because you raised the appropriate question. We brought this issue to a vote in this House, you know, in 1998. But the roadblock to getting anything done on this issue is the U.S. Senate. And let me tell you why. When you get elected to be a member of the U.S. Senate, you've got a 6-year lease on life. And I can tell you, are you ready for this? Hope you're sitting down.
I'm sitting down.
The principal reason for the existence of the U.S. Senate by a majority of the U.S. senators, I'm not talking by a few guys, few members or friends of mine who are patriots. They want to do what's best for America. But the majority sentiment that dictates the control of the U.S. Senate in our lifetime, you know what it is?
What's that?
Getting reelected.
Well.
Getting reelected.
That's a shock.
I'm not saying that individual senators support that when you talk to them, but that's the sense of what happens to you when you get there. And there's a crude word that I could use, but since it is crude, I won't express it over this broadcast, but it displays the disdain that a majority of the members of the U.S. Senate have for what I'm talking about. They don't really care. I'll repeat it. They don't really care what in the world the American public wants done about an issue like this. They're there to get reelected.
I see, but again, if a majority of people is behind this, wouldn't it help their reelection effort?
You don't understand it. When you have a 6-year lease on political life, you don't have to pay attention to anybody. I'm talking about the sense of the U.S. Senate, because, you know, they can say almost anything. And then, you know, 2 or 4 or 6 years go by until they get up for re-election.
We've been talking to former Congressman Bill Dannemeyer, who's been talking to us about school prayer and his position on the subject. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz and then more discussion with former Congressman Dannemeyer. It's time for another constitutional quiz, and here with us, as always, is our quiz lady, Kelly Carmichael.
Hello, how are you?
I am doing so well that it should be illegal. In fact, I think it is illegal in several states. So do you have a really hard question for us today, Kelly?
I do. I think we have a good one to start off with.
Good, because on the phone we have Brad from Salt Lake City, and I don't know about you, but I really want to stick it to him.
So, Brad, are you okay with that?
Sure, go ahead, try to stick it to me.
Okay, we are going to give you the hardest question we can think of, Brad, and recall, remember now, there's a great deal on the line, because only if you answer this question correctly will you get your weekly constitutional T-shirt.
All right.
Ooh, I want one of those T-shirts.
You can have a T-shirt, too. All righty, absolutely. Okay, so what is our question for today?
All right, well, I have a quote for you, and it refers to a particular concept. So I'm going to read the quote and then give you a multiple choice option for you to decide what concept this quote refers to. And this is from the Declaration of Independence. And the quote is, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. And the quote below refers to the concept of, is it A, social contract theory, B, right of revolution, C, natural law theory, or D, inalienable rights?
While Brad's thinking about that, can you say it again so I can follow along?
Sure thing. The quote, again, from the Declaration of Independence was, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. And that particular quote refers to the concepts of, is it A, social contract theory, B, right of revolution, C, natural law theory, or D, inalienable rights?
Very interesting. So you've thrown him a curveball right out of the box. You started with the Declaration of Independence, and this poor guy thought he was going to be quizzed on the Constitution. All right. Well, Brad from Salt Lake City, do you think you've got any answer for us?
I do. I think it goes to social contract theory.
So you think it is A, social contract theory. Well, can you tell me why you didn't think it was the other ones?
Let me see. It doesn't go to inalienable rights. I just think that's a bad answer. It doesn't go to natural, to natural law, because it doesn't talk about natural rights of the governed as, I guess, existing outside of individuals. So it just seemed to me like it goes to social contract theory. It's an agreement by individuals going to, it's just an agreement by the governed among themselves that they will basically, I can't think of the word.
That's all right. They'll all agree to be bound by the same law.
They'll govern each other. Yeah, they'll all agree to be bound together.
I think that's a pretty good answer, so I'm just going to chime in here. So I'm going to be betting on Brad on this one. So what's the real answer, Kelly?
Well, Brad, congratulations. You are going to get your very own Your Weekly Constitutional T-shirt.
Yay, marvelous. You are a winner. And are you going to wear your T-shirt proudly?
I will wear my T-shirt proudly.
All right. Well, we'll be very proud of you. Thank you very much, Brad, for being on the show, and we'll make sure and get that T-shirt to you shortly.
Great. Thanks for having me.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
We're back, and let's resume our fascinating discussion with former Congressman Bill Dannemeyer about school prayer. Well, getting back to the basic issue of school prayer, how do you answer critics who say, if they're agnostics, for example, or if they're atheists, that prayer simply has no place in public schools because, of course, public schools are funded by people of many different faiths or, in some cases, of no faith at all?
I say that if you want to be in America and you want to respect to the basis upon which we exist, this is a nation that was founded, on a belief in God, the existence of God. And from the beginning of the time of the history of this country, instruction in schools was basically, in the 13 colonies, in private schools. Some of them were, state, but most of them were private schools, and then the public school movement got started. And I can tell you, when you get to the question, that in my opinion today, any Christian parent raising children should take their children out of the public school, totally, and treats them, and, they can teach them in homeschool or in a parochial school in your community, and on the internet, you can find an identification of curriculum that is, prepared with substance that can assist a homeowner from, teaching their children with twin goals of education of competence and conscience. And if you want to live in America, those are the conditions under which we exist as a people. At least that's what I believe. Now, I realize there are people around who, and I think this is the biggest problem facing America today is a lot of things, but the biggest one is that we've lost our moral compass giving direction to the ship of state. You cannot successfully run a country on a belief that there is no God, there are no standards. And unfortunately, that's where we are today.
Well, actually, I just was speaking with a person who made the very forcefully the opposite point, who said that the Constitution is a godless document, that it makes no mention of God except in a negative way of preventing religious tests, for example, and preventing right. establishments of religion, and who insisted exactly the opposite of what you're saying, said that this is not a nation that was founded on a belief in God, but as a purely secular enterprise. How would you respond to that?
Well, that person is entitled to their point of view, certainly, and I respect that. But I don't want to have my children or my grandchildren in a classroom situation where that philosophy is being taught.
If you had your way, if you were able to wave a magic wand and change Supreme Court precedents, do you think that we would be better as a nation if we could go back to an era where there were explicitly Christian school-led prayers in public schools?
No, I didn't say that.
I'm asking.
When I say I support voluntary school prayer, what I'm talking about is those students who have a conviction for expressing, they be allowed at the beginning of the classroom to have a prayer. And the teacher should not draft it. The school board should not draft it. But those students should have the ability to express God as part of the educational process.
Now, would that apply to any religious belief?
Well, if that's a majority of the community, they have the right to express it. If you live in a community where you have Muslims or you have Jews, those people have a right to, you know, to have a say, and they should, and their right should be respected.
So it would be
a state legislature.
So it would be whatever the local majority religion is in a given school.
There is diversity of religious beliefs in this country. I respect that. I don't want to change that, but I do. The whole idea. There are two goals, I'll say it again, in public education. Education of competence and conscience. And you can't create a people in a civilization, which we call the American civilization, when you ignore both of them. And we've ignored both of them today. And we have a dominant philosophy controlling America today that says there is no God, there are no standards, you can do anything you want to. You know, even abuse, you can take drugs. One of the big, you know, we got, you can believe this as we speak. There are people around that want to, you know, mandate that we teach homosexuality as part of the lifestyle. That's not what God's word. The Bible is very clear on human sexuality. It's one man and one woman.
Okay. Getting back to school prayer, now, you've mentioned several times that there's a diversity of opinion. Now, I'll have to give you a tough question, though. Let's say that locally there were a majority of Wiccans, you know, sometimes called witches, and they wanted to have a school prayer and they wanted to pray to whatever God they believe in.
If they can convince the local city council or board of supervisors, they should have a turn to speak. They should have the right to do it.
And they should take up class time in a public school to do that.
If you have some students that want to, you know, say that, they have the right to do that.
Okay, and I'm going to ask you an even tougher question now.
Right.
Let's say we have a local bunch of Satan worshipers who want to do that in school. Should we allow them to take up class time?
That's a close question as to whether, you know, I'm not convinced that Satan worshipers are a religious group. I think they're just a pain in the you-know-what.
But again, how would you tell the difference between a group that had a legitimate, sincere religion?
You know, if you're in a public classroom and you've got some Satan worshipers that you don't want to be there, and they, you know, develop a so-called prayer, it doesn't take long before the rest of the class students to assert what I call collective discipline. There are certain decencies that have to be observed in any religious practice. Your example, you know, when you're studying math or history or English, there are certain rules you have to observe. You've got to pay attention to the teacher, you follow the discipline, you take tests, you don't cheat. Well, there are certain things you follow even when you're praying. And, you know, I would not, some Indians, I guess, have a war whoop as part of their religious practice. How do you handle that? But you have to respect the diversity of religious belief of people, and you got to do it. And I don't quarrel with that.
Now, when you say collective discipline, you mean if a bunch of Satan worshippers were doing a Satanistic prayer in class, that perhaps out in the playground that day, that the other students would have to.
I don't know that you do a prayer on a playground. I think you do it at the beginning of a class day.
Yeah, but I'm saying if we had a Satanist group of students up in front, and again, I'm just trying to figure out the, you know, what the limits are here, and they did a prayer, and the other students found...
Let me tell you, Stuart, students have a way, there's certain conduct that exhibit what I call a manifestation of Galatians 5, verse 22, the fruits of the Spirit, peace, joy, bliss. You got to respect your fellow man, and if you're engaging in a so-called religious exercise that doesn't respect, you know, traditional respect for other people, students have a way of taking care of that.
You talking about busting heads on the playground?
I didn't say that.
Okay, well, I guess.
But that's, you know, when people cross the line between decency and rudeness, there's ways that we all can take care of it.
I see. All right. Well, I see our time is just about up. And Bill Dannemeyer, I'd like to thank you very
much. I have a website.
Okay, you have a website. What's your website?
TakeBackOurRights.org.
TakeBackOurRights.org, okay.
Yeah, my wife has a website, drday.com, drday.com.
We've been talking with former Congressman Bill Dannemeyer about the ever-controversial subject of school prayer. After the break, we're going to hear from the other side. We'll be talking with Annie Laurie Gaylor, the co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Get set. It's going to be exciting. Well, she's back. Kelly Carmichael is back, and I'm just betting that she wants to tell us what's happening this week at James Madison's Montpelier.
All right. Yeah, we've started a new weekly tour that we do in addition to the house tour, more themed tours that we do, and one of the tours that we do is our constitutional tour.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense. So generally you'd go there and you might be
go
talking more
the
about
house,
the house or this, something.
Yeah, okay. The house and the architecture, but this is for folks who want to come and go see the mansion, but also focus a little bit more on the Constitution.
You mean like folks who might be listening to this show?
Like people on this show.
Okay, so this is a tour specifically for your weekly constitutional listeners. Okay.
And the tour is led by some of my colleagues, including myself at times, from the Center for the Constitution staff.
Okay.
And will take place at 1 p.m. on Friday, and experts from the Center for the Constitution will explore the Constitution, the document itself, and how it has defined our nation over 225 years.
No more appropriate place to do it, because upstairs, of course, in the library, was where James Madison apparently spent his time thinking about the Constitution.
These important constitutional principles.
Thinking up his Virginia plan. Yeah. Oh, that sounds. And that's every Friday afternoon?
Every Friday at 1 p.m. So you can learn more about this special tour at Montpelier.org.
Montpelier.org, and I bet also at center.montpelier.org, too.
Yep.
Because, of course, it's you Center for the Constitution people who are doing it. Well, you teachers out there, or any of you who are listeners, please, this is the time to go. This is the time to go, because that's what you're most interested in when you go to Montpelier. Not that the other stuff's boring, but this really hits it. So
we like to think that we're the center of it all.
You are the center. Thanks, Kelly. Appreciate your time.
By now, you probably know that 2010 was a census year. Do you know why? It's because the Constitution calls for a census. Article 1, Section 2 states, "The actual enumeration shall be made within 3 years after the first meeting of the Congress of the United States, and within every subsequent term of 10 years in such matter as they shall by law direct." The first census took place in 1790, and we've had one every 10 years ever since. In 2010, U.S. Census Bureau Director Robert Groves visited Montpelier to shoot a video for the census website. The Census Bureau released the video on James Madison's 259th birthday. The shoot took place in Montpelier's second floor library, where Madison researched past democracies. This research laid the framework for the Virginia Plan, the starting point for our Constitution. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
We're now going to talk to Annie Laurie Gaylor, the co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
That's right. We're based here in Madison, Wisconsin, and we're a state church watchdog, and we are also the largest national association of atheists and agnostics. So we have about 16,000 members around the country.
Okay. Well, I think I probably know where you stand on the issue of school prayer. But what I want to ask is what is your position? Why do you believe in it? And why is this still relevant all these years after the Supreme Court, I thought, had addressed this issue?
Well, we don't think public school prayer should have a prayer, but unfortunately this is an issue that doesn't go away, especially in the South. And the law is very settled, and you're right, it's been more than 50 years of solid Supreme Court precedent right up until, you know, into the 2000s, saying there should not be any government prayer, there shouldn't be any teacher-hosted intercom prayer, shouldn't be scheduled in the day, there shouldn't be commencement prayer, there shouldn't be student-led prayer. Nobody should be asking public school students to pray, but it happens a lot.
And okay, let's pause there and make sure we got the parameter set that we're talking about public schools. Okay, we're only talking about government-funded schools, and so in some sense a public school is a branch of the government. We're not talking about private schools, so this none of our discussion has anything to do with a Catholic school or a non-denominational Christian school or a Muslim school or anything like that.
Well, unless it's one of these unfortunate situations where there are vouchers going to religious schools.
Okay. Well, I was just trying to keep it straight. But if you have a purely privately funded religious school, that's off the table at the moment. We're talking about schools that have some sort of nexus to the government, some sort of government funding.
Otherwise it's a terrible violation of personal conscience to have your government taking your kids and telling them, you better pray, this is the God you're supposed to pray to, here's what you're going to say, or you should be praying.
Right. Okay, but constitutionally speaking, we're only talking about public schools, and what we're saying is that the First Amendment of the Constitution has been interpreted by the Supreme Court to prohibit teachers or administrators at public schools from leading or mandating certain prayers or any prayers at all. But that the individual students, of course, are not being coerced one way or the other in terms of what they may privately say to themselves or think to themselves during school hours. We're only talking about something that's done openly and publicly, in some sense, by the school.
Well, yes, and actually, I mean, we've seen a lot of backdoor approaches on this where they'll try to say, we're just going to tell students that you can set aside time for meditation or prayer, for example, and the U.S. Supreme Court has spoken on that. That's also a no-no, because it's a suggestion. It's really an endorsement by the school that we're suggesting you might want to pray. I mean, there really just shouldn't be any religious ritual. There shouldn't be any indoctrination, proselytization of students during the school day by public schools.
Okay, and you say that public schools have been trying to resist these Supreme Court holdings? What sort of resistance, what sort of forms has this taken other than these moments of meditation?
At the Freedom From Religion Foundation, we now have two non-litigation staff attorneys who handle a lot of violations. You know, hundreds and hundreds of people contact us every year asking us to stop violations, and the number one complaint that we deal with is public schools, and it's religion in public schools in some form or another. And we have just stopped two prayers. One of them was at an elementary school level where children were reciting God is good, God is great, we thank him for the food we eat, amen, kind of thing. The kind of thing that was going on in public schools, in some public schools, when the Supreme Court first ruled on this in the early 60s. And then another one, very egregious.
Before we go on, Annie Laura, if I may ask you, that's a what most people would probably describe as a very neutral or ecumenical prayer. You know, God is great, God is good, we thank him for our food, amen. It's a very common prayer. So could you explain why such a, you know, a relatively neutral, relatively non-denominational sort of prayer would still be beyond the scope of the Constitution? Why would that be objectionable?
Because the Supreme Court hasn't said, oh, you can have non-denominational prayer in your schools. I mean, there is a ruling sort of to that effect with state legislators involving only them and involving adults in a different situation. I don't agree with that decision, but non-denominational doesn't cut it in a public school because all of us go to the public schools. We all pay for them, and 15% or more of the population is not religious. It is a usurpation of the parental role, a terrible usurpation for the school to indoctrinate children that there is a God, even a non-denominational God, and that God is good and God is great. And this is doctrinaire. This is dogma. This isn't something that you are supposed to imbibe at a school. This is something that you're taught by your parents if they wish, or they can send you to a church. But a public school is not a church. And from the point of view of an atheist or agnostic, that is a very chilling prayer. If you were to hear your small child come in and recite that to you, as one of our complainants did, this would appall you.
Mm-hmm.
And rightly so. And we stopped it immediately because it is such a gross violation. We didn't have any trouble once we brought this to the attention of the superintendent. I mean, sometimes we do, but we also have stopped, and I'm going to have to look for it, but it was somebody had rewritten the words of Frère Jacques for school children.
The song?
Had,
okay. Mm-hmm.
Yes, the song, and I think I can find those words for you. I just, let's see, here it is. God our Father, once again, we will ask a blessing. We will ask a blessing. Ah, amen.
You know, I think I've heard that. I've heard that sung by school children in a...
Well, we'd never heard it.
Uh-huh. Okay, all right.
This came from North Carolina, the Edgecombe Public Schools in Tarboro, North Carolina. We found out from a parent that a kindergarten teacher was leading, you know, 5- and 6-year-olds in this proselytizing prayer that they were supposed to sing before lunch. I mean, this is a constitutional no-no, and it's also a terrible thing to do because it's a violation of authority. It is taking little tiny children who don't have the faintest idea what those words mean and making them recite them as part of a public school day.
Yeah, and once again, even though it sounds relatively innocuous, probably to most people, because, of course, we still are a majority, a nation where most people at least identify themselves, self-identify as being Protestants or Christians of one form or another, even though that sounds relatively innocuous and ecumenical, it is assuming that there is a God, or it's stating that there is a God. It's stating that God is a male figure, a
right,
father.
Right, our father.
Right, and that we're asking for the approval of this God through a blessing. And then we're ending with a religious salutation, amen. So even though that might seem rather relatively neutral and innocuous to a lot of religious people, to, I guess, an atheist or an agnostic, there are several things in there that they don't necessarily agree with.
Well, and but also, if you could be Muslim, you could be Hindu,
right?
You could be Wiccan. There could be all kinds of minority beliefs that would be very offended by this as well. And religion in schools creates walls between children, and you don't have religious ritual in our public schools because you can have that at home and in church. There are most of your school day and most of the days most of the hours of the day are not spent in school, and we have complete religious expression and freedom of religion, and you can take your child to any church or Bible camp or whatever you like, or tell them anything you like, or have them learn any prayer or hymn you like, but the school does not get involved in that.
Yeah.
And that's also one of the reasons that the courts are so scrupulous about protecting the freedom of conscience of parents and their school children, because children are impressionable, and they don't even know what you're talking about at this age. These are ideas that are beyond their ability to even understand.
Well, that's actually the question I really want to hit on, then, is that if you're still, this, it's been 40, 50 years, I mean, depending on which decision you're talking about, since the Supreme Court declared that this sort of thing is unconstitutional. What I find remarkable is that you're still getting this many complaints, because even if an individual school administrator or teacher disagrees with the Supreme Court's ruling, it is the law of the land. And to what do you attribute the fact that people are just ignoring it?
Well, in as I said, in the South, and I don't like to typecast, but there are whole pockets where I don't think they've ever stopped anything that they were doing after these Supreme Court decisions. And what happens is, as our nation becomes more mobile, more people are moving around, coming into these smaller communities and realizing something's wrong, then they're more apt to complain to a group like us. And as our group gets bigger and people know we're here, we're more apt to hear about it. But we spent, our legal staff spent almost the entire month of October ending football prayer in the state of Tennessee. And it was as soon as we got one Saucy Daisies where it started, and then it just boomeranged all around the state, we got more and more people contacting us to say they're doing this at my school too. And they were mostly Christian prayers. And we're still cleaning up in Tennessee over this. And we wrote all of the superintendents because we were so concerned that this was so ingrained. We took a case in, we won in Dayton, Tennessee in 2004, where they were actually people from William Jennings Bryan Bible College.
Right.
Which was named in honor of Bryan after the Scopes trial.
Right, which took place in Dayton, right.
It took place in Dayton, and he started a Bible college. And for who knows, probably since the late 20s, those Bible students were going into the public schools, into the grade schools, and were having a very fundamentalist Christian Sunday school lesson every week for an hour. And this had probably been going on from the 20s, but the school did not keep adequate records. But we know it was at least 75 years going on. And when one of the families, which was from the South, but they were from another area, moved in and complained to us, and it was a huge battle. I mean, it was like, we called it Scopes True. Scopes 2.
Scopes 2, uh-huh.
The whole community wanted to find out who the plaintiffs were. We had a protective order. We had to go to court to protect the protective order. School board members there were officials who said they were going to reveal the names, and we had to protect them. And we won, and then the school board just wasted money and voted to appeal. And then when we won again at the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, they finally let it rest. Well, we were citing the McCollum case from 1948,
yeah,
which is still the precedent, which is Vashti McCollum took that case to the Supreme Court when her child was coming home with a permission slip to either take Catholic or Protestant religious indoctrination in the schools. And she fought it and won. A very firm decision, but that is still the law today. And yet that school district wouldn't listen to that 1948 case, and we had to refight that case and win it again in 2004. So it is a constant battle, and you would hopefully we don't have to go to court on all of this. We usually were able to stop them now with a letter.
You know, it is just remarkable that these cases have been around so long and they're so widely ignored. I'm imagining that in some of these cases where they insist upon appealing and fighting, that you're probably getting some pretty sizable attorney fee awards, aren't you?
We never make any money on our lawsuits.
Oh, no, no. I'm not suggesting you're making money, but I'm saying,
yes,
but I mean, that there are fee-shifting provisions in the relevant federal statutes when law is this clearly established and when the violation is that clear.
Yes, and the way that it worked was that the attorneys kept track of their hours in that Dayton, Tennessee case, and they were repaid by the people of Dayton, Tennessee, and it was very costly.
Yeah.
It was a very reckless misuse of taxpayer money to fight that battle.
Yeah, that's actually it's just going to what I was saying. Again, one of the many aspects of this that I find difficult to understand is that people are willing to do this despite these clear precedents and despite the fact that it's going to cost them a lot of time and money, not just their own legal fees, but possibly having to pay the legal fees of the plaintiffs because of the fee-shifting provisions in the relevant statutes.
Well, I would hope in this economy that people would care about that, but I would hope more that they would care about the harm to children. And just looking at the McCollum case, I don't know if you're aware that National Public TV is going to be debuting a new documentary called The Lord Was Not on Trial, and it's about the McCollum case.
Is that going to be on PBS?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
And Jim McCollum, who's personal friend, and he was the little boy in the case, and his brother, Dan, were involved in this case. And it was terrible. It was so terrible that Jim had to leave town during the appeals of this decision. And he and his brother had to find creative ways, they said, to get home every day. They'd be beaten up. When he wasn't taking the religious instruction, they would put him in the hallway or in the music room, which were places of detention. And teachers would come by and make cracks about him, and other kids would all go after him. And this is what happens when you have religion in the schools. I mean, we've seen, you know, people being beat up. We've seen persecution. Ishmael Jaffrey, who took the Jaffrey case that was against prayer and meditation in Alabama, he was a black father in a white community, and his children were beaten up terribly. I mean, it was persecution for defending the Constitution. So it's really important that school children be protected from that, that they should make up their own minds about religion. And I think it's government tyranny for the government schools to propose to interfere in any way with whether kids worship or not.
I'd like to return to a point you made earlier, that one reason that you posited that these cases are now coming out is that we have a more mobile society, and people are moving more frequently into areas where there hasn't been a lot of movement in the past. And so populations are less homogenous than they used to be. And so these plaintiffs are coming into circumstances, and then they are protesting, and they're paying a price, as you've pointed out. How do you answer critics who will make statements like the following? We're the majority here. We're all Christians. We've been here a long time. Majority should rule, and you outsiders are just agitators, and you just need to let us do things the way we've always done them, because we're in the majority.
Well, first of all, I would say that Vashti McCollum's family was not an outsider family in their Champaign home in Illinois. I mean, that's not true. But secondly, I guess that I would ask them to pick up their Constitution and open up the Bill of Rights. And this would be a basic civic lesson, that we do not have, you do not vote on religion. I mean, if a majority of people in your town are Catholic, that doesn't mean you have to tithe to the Catholic Church and go to the Catholic Church. I mean, that's the kind of tyranny that some of our ancestors came to this country to avoid.
We've been speaking to Annie Laurie Gaylor of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. And speaking of tyranny, the clock on the wall, once again, sadly must cut off our discussion. And I'm going to give the last few moments of our program to my student, Amber Howe. Amber, is this sort of stuff still going on? Is this still a current issue?
It is. Today in East Tennessee, there are still several schools that are struggling with keeping the wall of separation between the church and the state.
Really? Right here in East Tennessee?
From the prayer before the football games to handing out Gideon Bibles in the school to the children.
That happened over in White County, didn't it?
It did. And then several of the instances happened outside of Chattanooga, the prayer before the football games.
Are those court cases, or have they been resolved without the need to go to court?
They're still pending. Families have complained, and the school system is waiting to figure out what their options are to respond.
People have strong feelings on this issue, and it's one of those issues that doesn't seem to be going away anytime soon. Thank you for explaining it to us, and thank you to all of our guests who have helped us today. Thank you to Annie Laurie Gaylor of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Thank you to former Congressman Bill Dannemeyer, who shared with us his opinions about school prayer. Thanks to my student, Amber Howe, from the Appalachian School of Law. Thanks to our executive producer, Wayne Winkler. And thanks to me, too, because I've been here all throughout it. My name is Stuart Harris. Thank you for listening. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.